Osiris.
Hello, everyone. My name's RJ. I'm here with my friend Brian Brinkman. This might look like HF Pod, but it's not, is it, Brian?
It's not. It's the unknown right now. It's a new show. It's crazy, huh?
Yeah, it's. We're doing our first episode today of this new show called The Live Show. And why do we call it The Live Show? You might ask. You might not ask because it's fairly obvious. But we are bringing you this show live 3 days a week to talk about live releases from some of your favorite artists. And Brian and I have been talking for a long time about digging into the Dave Matthews Band's live catalog. And then we started getting a bunch of comments on HF Pod and elsewhere that said, you know, why don't you guys give some other bands like you've done for Phish and go deeper on live releases. So that's why we're here. And Brian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. I took a run. I listened to some music. It's a nice day out here in Denver. I'm great. How are you?
I'm good. I was just packing up the car to go to the beach later today.
Beautiful.
And that's when, like, you know, summer really starts when you pack for the beach. You know what I mean? So I'm excited.
The beach, the vacation, the road trip—it's all a part of this point in summer where you have kids who are either in camp or they're at home. You don't really know where they are, and you've got to just like get them all into a car and go someplace where you do basically the same thing you do at home. You're just supposed to be relaxing. It's a wonderful tradition.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't know. I don't like the schedule's all messed up. Everything's all messed up, but it's good. So it's earlier in the day than we typically do HF Pod. I'm still drinking espresso. I'm you know, we're early here. Brian has his coffee, so it's basically a coffee conversation sort of thing. But I guess the first thing we should start with is just why we're doing this. So what we're going to do is 3 days a week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we're going to do this at 12 Eastern, and we are going to talk about a live release from a band. We're going to start with the Dave Matthews Band, these live releases called Live Tracks, and today's will be from December 8th, 1998, from Worcester, and we're going to get into that in a second, but we really want to just kind of dive in more deeply on other artists' catalogs and see, you know, see what we find. Brian, what else would you add?
I guess, you know, I am a catalog listener. I feel like something of a completist. When a band puts out a large catalog of live music in an intentional package, it's really appealing to me to listen to volumes in order of how they distributed it. And as we dove into this, you know, we initially thought of Dave Matthews Band, but then we looked around. There's so many artists that over the last 20 years have taken the Dick's Picks, the Live Phish model, and spun it out in their own way to really put out some of their best concerts so that their fans, that listeners can really hear them as they're developing, as they're growing, as they're evolving as an artist. And diving into that conversation, I think, is going to be really fascinating.
So before we get into the show, 98, this show, we're going to talk about the Worcester Centrum. This show happens to have taken place about 10 days after Phish's amazing 3-day run at the same venue. But before we get into that, Brian, what's your history with the Dave Matthews Band? Like what's your fan trajectory? Would you describe yourself as a big fan? Like where do they fit into your musical landscape?
Yeah, you know, it's going to be really interesting to explore that throughout the series. It's one of the things I'm most excited for about, like, our first segment here, diving into Dave Matthews. Dave Matthews Band was my first jam band love. You know, I was given Red Rocks 95. I was given listener supported like late 90s, and it just really connected in a way that type of music, experimental music, music that had aspects of Americana folk, jazz, bluegrass, even slight aspects of funk. I hadn't really heard of the music I was listening to at that point in time. I was listening to a lot of alternative rock on the radio. And Dave Matthews Band really taught me what a live element could add to a band when you change up the set list, when you add experimentation and jamming. And so, you know, around 16, 17, Dave Matthews Band was the most important band in the world to me. And around that time, I discovered Phish, and that became the most important band in the world to me. And I went down a rabbit hole that I'm still going down. And admittedly, I kind of lost touch with the Dave Matthews Band for a while. Somewhere in the last 5 or 6 years, I became really curious about the band again and started exploring these live releases that they had put out. So I'm kind of coming at this as someone who is not necessarily a noob, but is like a recent convert again. And that adds an aspect of like, I know everything about the 90s. And then there's this big blank period where I have no idea what happened. And I cannot wait to dive into that and explore that and kind of rediscover this band 25 years later. What about you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, everyone who's watched HF Pod knows, because we talk about it a lot, I'm older than you, Brian, which is good and bad in different ways. when Under the Table and Dreaming came out, I was 15, and that was like that album, I feel like, changed my whole understanding of music. Like, I was just, you know, at 15, I was just starting to collect Fish tapes. I was just starting to understand the Beatles, and Modesky Martin and Wood was another band that I discovered like right around this time. And Under the Table and Dreaming was just like a huge part of my upbringing, and Crash, you know. And then like I went to college, and then I kind of like, same thing, started going on Fish tour and fell off. But my wife and I will go, and like on a Friday night, if we're listening to music, we'll put on a live tracks once in a while. And it's just always, it's always good. You know what I mean? It's, and one thing that's interesting is, how many live tracks are there? They're like 50.
There's currently 59.
So one of the things about this series, which I wonder if listeners and viewers agree, like, how much different are these shows from each other? That's one of the things I'm sort of fascinated to find out. Like, when you're going through the Deads with Dick's Picks, obviously, it's what, there's a 91 and a 71 and a, you know, 78. They're all so different in terms of the makeup of the band. And I don't know, I'm sort of excited to kind of dive in and see, like, what do we hear that's different, and what kind of remains the same? Because this show, so let's just talk about the show a little bit. It's December 8th, 1998 from Worcester, Massachusetts. I think it's interesting that as their first live release, or part of this series anyway, there were other live releases, obviously, but this came out in 2004, and it there's a bunch of guests on it, you know? So, which is just sort of like, if you think about a live Fish release or a Dick's Picks, like, they're not going to release a show with a bunch of guests, right? Which is just sort of a fascinating difference. And I wonder if that was part of the impetus.
Yeah, it's interesting. And a lot of the early releases from this that go back into the 90s tend to have Bela Fleck and the Flecktones on it, which this show has. And I'm really glad they did that, because, you know, when I was first getting into the Dave Matthews Band, Bela Fleck was one of those bands that I jumped to off of Dave Matthews and off of like the recommendation of them. And one of the things I love about, and one of the things I'm really interested to dive into, to your point about like, how different is this band from release to release to release, is there's a real collaborative nature, it seems, to the Dave Matthews Band, and especially post Leroy's passing in the late 2000s, the band has become this kind of stage for artists who are at the top of their game from both a studio, from a musicianship standpoint, to come and really showcase their skills and fit in with the band. You think about Tim Reynolds, you think about Jeff Coffin and the work that he's done with the band. And it's just wild to me. You're totally right. It's something Fish would have never done. And I want to pause really quick. We're not going to spend this entire series comparing Dave Matthews to Fish. It's just it's a good, you know, working off point for people of our reference, point.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, like, you think about Fish's first live Fish release, it's from December 1995, this hallowed period in the band's history. This first live tracks release, from everything I've ever read about Dave Matthews, from everything I've ever heard, this December 98 tour is one of the strongest tours in the band's history. So it really makes sense that they would showcase themselves in this catalog with a show from this era. But then also, Bela Fleck doesn't take away from what they're playing. He only adds to it in throughout some of the biggest standout points in this show. So I think it's an interesting move, but I also think it's really fitting.
So, Brian, tell what was happening in December of 1998. I was a sophomore in college, so I didn't know what was going on outside of going to class and whatever else I was doing at the time. You know, college is amazing in that way. Like, I don't even remember anything that was happening outside of my own experience. It's kind of like the only time in your life that you get to just be oblivious to the world. What was happening in 1998? Is there anything, any context that we need to know before we start talking about this concert?
I think that there's some fun pop cultural context to talk about. I mean, December 1998, this is, I was in eighth grade. So this really showcases our age gap in a really funny way, because like where we are right now, I'm in my late 30s, you're in your early 40s. Like, we both have kids. There's a lot of similarities to our life.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you dive back into the late 90s, we're in very, very different places.
It would have been weird if you were visiting me at college when you were in eighth grade.
There have been a lot of things I would not have been able to do that you would have probably been doing on a regular basis. And, you know, we just, we would have made it work somehow. It would have all been the music that would have brought us together.
Yeah.
But I was looking at just like songs, movies, and TV shows, because 1998 to me feels like this very Halcyon period in my life. You know, the worst thing that was happening was the Clinton impeachment trials that were going on. Overall, as a kid in America in the late 1990s, it's a pretty sweet place to be. Songs wise, I was looking at the top five songs during this week on the Billboard charts. And it all brings back memories of middle school dances, where we would be separated by teachers if you were dancing too closely, which was another reason to start listening to Dave Matthews Band, because it allowed you to move away from family, move away from like authority, and kind of start to explore the world around you. But the top five songs, you had number five, Shania Twain's From This Moment On, Lauryn Hill's Doo Wop, That Thing, Divine, Lately, Deborah Cox's Nobody's Supposed to Be Here, and R. Kelly and Celine Dion, I'm Your Angel, a pairing that I think Celine Dion would go back and she would avoid that if she could.
Is this, I was thinking about this morning, like, were the late 90s a little bit of a lost period in terms of popular music? Because like there's no, this is basically all kind of R&B slash pop. There's not a lot of like, you know, it's post grunge, right? It's kind of pre like Radiohead and alternative music kind of making a comeback. It's a little bit of a lull in popular music, at least based on the top five songs from that time.
I mean, the biggest, I think probably the best song on this list is the Lauryn Hill Doo Wop. That album was incredible in 98. But this was an era, I don't know if I'm really showing my age right now, but I would come home from school with my friends and we'd watch TRL. And this all is dominated on that list. Boy bands. I'm really surprised that there's no Backstreet Boys or NSYNC at this point in time.
Yeah, they were in the studio.
They were crafting their masterpiece, the Millennium album. It's really interesting when you look at the movies as well, because number five is The Waterboy, which was one of the biggest movies for a 13-year-old boy to come out at the time. Did you go and see that? Did you have any interest in Adam Sandler at that point in time?
No, definitely not. And definitely not. I'd say that I just watched Hustle. Last year I watched Uncut Gems, and those are probably the first Adam Sandler movies I've seen since 1996.
Well, we finally found something in common based on where we were at in 98. Number four was the Rugrats movie, which was, you know, like you put out a cartoon, you have to make a movie out of it. Number three, Enemy of the State, a political thriller that doesn't really hold up. It really just like, it's a ridiculous political thriller. Will Smith and Gene Hackman. Number two was the remake of Psycho. Do you remember they shot this frame for frame, but it was, you know, updated actors. Vince Vaughn was in it. Who's the father from Shameless that was in it as well? He was in Fargo. I'm blanking on this guy's
name.
William H. Macy, thank you. And number one was A Bug's Life, which I think was a Pixar film, which just makes sense. It was that Thanksgiving hangover.
I guess Big Lebowski came out in 98 at the beginning of the year. I mean, there were some movies that were really good if you were smoking weed and being in college in 1998. But that's not what we're here to talk about, unfortunately.
It's not.
I do want to give a shout out to antsmarching.org, where I got a bunch of info on this tour and the some of the song choices and guests and all that stuff. Brian, this was, I think this was show 32 of 40 of this fall tour, which is a big, it's a big tour. Do you want to say anything before we start talking about the songs, about who was playing, like just kind of like where the band was at this point in the tour?
Yeah, this was, as you said, this was late in the tour. They would close out the tour in Chicago, which they would also release as a official release, the Live in Chicago 12/19/98 tour. They kind of, they started in Miami in October. They went down to South America for a bit, went west, came through Canada, and then finished out the tour doing a Midwest run and a Northeastern circuit before swinging back to Chicago. Bela Fleck and the Flecktones were opening for this December leg of the overall tour, which saw them play Philadelphia, New York, Worcester, Auburn Hills, basically doing in a lot of cases the Phish touring circuit at this point in time. But we also had Butch Taylor and Tim Reynolds sitting in with the band for much of these shows. Butch Taylor on keyboards, Tim Reynolds obviously on guitar. Tim is there will be some Dave and Tim releases that will come later in the Live Tracks series. Tim Reynolds played just fascinating, mind-blowing guitar with Dave Matthews and really complimented his songwriting. And Butch Taylor had joined the band around this time to add keyboards, and he would remain with the band for a number of years to come.
There, that's like the keyboard thing is kind of the only like real mixing up that happens in DMB during these years, right? Like everyone else is kind of solidified.
Yeah, Tim is not an official. Tim and Butch are not official members of the band at this point in time. But every single show that I saw had Butch Taylor on keyboards with the band, and then I think the following year they would add backup singers who would join them for a number of songs throughout the next few tours.
So people watching or listening might not know, but there used to be these things called albums, and bands would release them. And then they would tour in support of promoting those albums. And this is one of those tours, right? They released an album this year. This is sort of like an album that I caught up on later. I definitely was not listening to it when it came out, because I would have had to go to, maybe I could have gone on Napster in 1998, but I definitely would have had to go to a store and buy a CD.
Physical store.
Yeah. Which I didn't do. I got a lot of tapes in the mail, but I wasn't buying CDs. But this was a pretty big promotional tour. Was that a pretty big album for them? Like compared to, you know, Under the Table and Dreaming, which is like certified multiple platinum, right? And then there's Crash, which I think was equally or like on the same level. And then did it start to kind of plateau, or were they still getting huge, huge responses to their albums?
Yeah, I think this is going to be like I want to put a pin in this particular topic, because I think this is something that I think we should be exploring throughout this larger series. And I think that this is an area that the both of us, I certainly have limited knowledge on where the band goes post Everyday and Busted Stuff. And so I'm really curious to explore it. But as I understand it, Before This Crowded Streets is really kind of the conclusion of the classic period of Dave Matthews Band, where if you take Under the Table and Dreaming and Crash as these kind of breaking out albums for the band, and these tours that really showcased, both of those albums are filled with songs that like there's nothing really skippable in any sort of standpoint. Before These Crowded Streets is that moody kind of follow-up to the big breakout success. You saw this a lot in the late 90s or in the 1990s with artists who would put out a huge record. Nobody knew who they were from a radio standpoint, from a pop standpoint. They may have, you know, a dedicated fan base, but then they're discovered on a larger scale. They suddenly have videos all over MTV, and they go in the studio, they're kind of exhausted, and they record this moody follow-up. And Before These Crowded Streets is that. This was my first current Dave Matthews Band record. This was the first one that I bought. This is still my favorite Dave Matthews Band record. And as a result of it, not to show my hand too early, but like I loved this release. I thought this was a fascinating release because you can really hear a lot of the influences and a lot of what made Before These Crowded Streets so fascinating. You know, it feels to me in the moment following this record, there was a lot of growth around the band in terms of they were playing sheds and they were playing arenas in a similar way to what we saw Phish at the time. But whereas Phish in 2000 plays Big Cypress, there's a lot of exhaustion around the band. They break away at that point. Dave Matthews goes all in. They make these two records, the Lily White Sessions, which would become Busted Stuff, and then Every Day, which was this very quick to production burst of inspiration for Dave Matthews from a writing standpoint. And that would be kind of this secondary push towards kind of solidifying pop stardom. To me, what makes Before These Crowded Streets so interesting is it's kind of that moody rebellion against the growing fan base. And you hear it, it's exhaustive at times. It's dark. The lyrics are really, there's a lot of like themes that you have to like piece and parse apart layers. So that's kind of where I hear the band at this point, and you get this really fascinating tour as a result of it.
So we said that we're not going to compare Phish and Dave Matthews the entire time, and we're not. And I also want to say we are going to bring on guests. It's not just going to be Brian and myself. We're going to have other Osiris hosts and friends, and you'll hear different perspectives. But there is a Steve Lillywhite connection between Phish and Dave Matthews, and Trey had already played with Dave at this point, and you know they were already friendly and you know all that. But there is a lot of crossover in the 90s between the two of them. But Dave, you know, one of the things about this show which we should get into is, man, I've listened to a lot of these, but if you just starting with the Seek Up opener and Seek Up, like the way that they ease into the actual song is just, it's so cool. You know, like Butch Taylor, like the piano is great. And there's so much patience. It's so patient, like getting into these songs. And as I'm listening to the show, I was realizing like Dave just constructing a good show is like, what, like at every point, like the song selection is just like perfect. You know, there's like a jam and then a crowd pleaser and then another jam and then another crowd pleaser. And every time there's a crowd pleaser, you know, because it's what sounds like thousands of women just screaming. And that's like, that's a pretty good sign if you're putting together a show. But what were your thoughts on like the first part of this show, highlights and all that?
Yeah, I really like how this show begins. I agree with you. Like the way that Seek Up starts, I just have such memories of the first time I listened to Live at Red Rocks. And, you know, to that point, my only other reference point to a band playing Red Rocks was U2's Under a Blood Red Sky. And that concert video begins with the song Surrender. The album, I believe, begins with Gloria. It begins in this very bombastic way. It's very U2. We're here. It's Red Rocks. Like, let's go right now. And I loved how Dave Matthews approached Red Rocks as, let's ease into this. This is a beautiful place. Let's just like set a mood and let's go. And this show begins in that same sort of manner. You referenced, we have like five more Phish comparisons left, and this is number five, I promise.
But stick you with referenced
you referenced the Worcester shows that Phish played just a few weeks earlier, and those shows are just like the show that was ultimately released 11/27. It's just insane energy from the jump, and that's like part of the joy of that show. And to have this band, Dave Matthews, a couple weeks later, walk in and play, you know, a building that is really celebrated by local Bostonian artists and then jam bands in a lot of cases, to have them walk in and just set the mood in this, you know, minor league hockey arena and have it just like slowly build over 18 minutes. I absolutely love that. You go into Linus and Lucy, you get a lot of Butch on keys at this point in time. You get this really cool jazzy jam segment. And then you go into Pantala Nagapampa and Rapunzel as the two songs that would open before these crowded streets, which tend to serve as a live show opener in a lot of cases, but like feel like, all right, we've already been through a 25-minute experience. Let's reset the show and let's go again. I love that flow to the start of this. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I realized after that the Linus and Lucy theme was a pretty big bust out. I think they've only done it 10 times in the band's history and last in 2005. So something that doesn't happen very much. And yeah, I mean, the Seek Up is just like, what a beautiful song. I'm probably going to end up saying that a lot when we're reviewing these releases, because I just think Dave's singing and his songwriting are just, they're so good and they age really well. You know, these songs are kind of timeless. I feel like there's a timeless quality to them. But the way that they segue in and out of these, and then, you know, the Rapunzel jam is, it sounds like there's like 20 people on stage without it sounding like cacophonous, you know?
Yeah.
Like it, you can tell it's, there's a lot of people, but it all works really well. And I feel like as a band leader conductor, you got to really be careful when you have a lot of people on stage, you know, it works really well. And then the Rapunzel, there's like a great jam and then just into Satellite and then people just like lose their minds. Like, it's just such a great, great call at that point in the show. And I felt like there were like a few points in the show where things kind of like reset based on one of these like more popular songs, you know. There's like, they kind of get out there and then they come back, whereas like Fish would do that or the Dead would do that with a big jam and then a ballad. But like, is Satellite a ballad? I guess sort of, but it still feels like it's, the energy isn't like ebbing and flowing. It's just sort of the song selection that helps to keep the momentum going.
It's one of the interesting aspects that, like, again, I want to explore throughout this series is, you know, you compare live tracks to Dick's picks, Dave's picks to the Live Fish series. Though the latter two bands, The Dead and Fish, never really had consistent hit singles. You know, obviously you had Touch of Grey, you've got the Down with Disease video, but like never anything that was a reference point for someone to show up for that one particular song. Dave Matthews in 1998 has 10 or 12 hit singles at this point in time. I mean, like videos that have been played thousands of times on MTV, songs that have gotten thousands of requests on radios, radio stations across the country, something that was still a huge deal at this point in time. I remember in 1998, Don't Drink the Water was one of the biggest requested songs on the station I listened to. Crash Into Me was still getting requests at this point in time. So it's a really interesting dynamic at play that you're talking about. And we see it in this show with Seek Up, Jimmy Thing, 41, and then the closing, The Last Stop, where the band is kind of figuring out how do we balance out these songs that allow us to really showcase our musicianship and really allow us to experiment as a collective unit with also these songs that we kind of have to play because there are people here that are showing up specifically to hear Satellite, specifically to hear Don't Drink the Water, like Stay, their most recent singles at the time. And I like how they kind of collect Satellite, Don't Drink the Water, Stay, all kind of in this similar segment while allowing themselves to explore it at various points during the show. It creates a lot of balance that I like.
I mean, Bela Fleck also, like, What a perfect addition to the sound. You know, it almost like doesn't sound like he's even, it sounds like he's just part of the band. Because like the acoustic, you know, the acoustic kind of nature of the band in a way, it just really adds a lot to it, I thought. It's interesting that he comes out for Don't Drink the Water and then leaves and comes back a bunch of different times. It's sort of like comes out for a song and leaves and then comes back and leaves again. And you can't really tell. It all sounds fine, you know, it's not like jarring or anything, but I think it's sort of interesting.
Yeah, aside from like they give him that really lengthy solo in number 41 that sounds really good towards the latter part of that jam, and then The Last Stop, like I feel like having him on is a really important aspect of that overall song. It is kind of wild to think that, you know, as he's backstage listening to the flow of the show and then coming on and just adding a little bit and just adding just enough. And he did that. He played a lot on Before These Crowded Streets. I think he's on The Last Stop. He's the banjo towards the end of that. I think he's on Halloween, that performance, but he's at this point in time, he's at a point where he's really interacting with the band and playing with the band and offering the band ideas and offering the band kind of an exit point from the structures of the song in a really cool way.
Yeah. Oh, look at this. We have a comment from, look at this guy.
Our man.
The dude, future guest. Yeah, that's number 41. Yeah, so they opened the whole tour, and I guess I have a question about this song. Is number 41 like a perfect song? Because lyrically, musically, it leads to a jam. Carter, like the drums are just like so consistent and so like predictably consistent in a way that it sets the table for like a great jam, and the lyrics are great. It's like people are losing it during the song. There's just people screaming. Like, it's like, this is kind of a perfect moment in a concert, if not a perfect song.
This is my favorite Dave Matthews Band song. I would agree. It is perfect. I think it is one of those songs. You can read the lyrics. You can hear the song 1,000 times and still walk away with like a semblance of mystery of what exactly is he singing about? What exactly is the intention of the song? It has lyrics that allow you the opportunity like to read about specifically what he was writing about, but then to interpret them in your own way whatsoever. And I love that about Dave lyrics at this time. One thing to put another kind of like pin in what we're going to, you know, explore throughout this series. I'm really curious to hear where this song evolves as we get to releases that come out like post 2002, because I have an inclination that the song was not used as much as a jam vehicle, if you will, as it was in the late 90s. And when Bela Fleck would come out and play, if I'm wrong, I'm going to be happy to be wrong, but I'm really curious to hear how this song evolves, because around this time, if you were getting into Dave Matthews in the late 90s, this was one of the first songs that someone told you, you have to listen to, immerse yourself in. And it's always stuck there for me as the best song that the band has written.
There's something about it that I think, yeah, is like, again, just sort of timeless. I mean, I think there's so many songs from these first couple albums and from this period that are just like, I don't know. I wonder if it's an age thing. I wonder if there are people like, are there 20 or 25 year olds who right now who love this song like we do, or is it a generational thing where we like got introduced to it at this kind of formative point in our lives?
That's another thing I'm really curious to learn about, because I spent some time over the weekend on the Ants Marching forum, just kind of scouring for information about this and kind of just seeing what people think about this show. And this is a really highly rated show on the forum. I was reading a number of threads of like ranking the live tracks, and pretty much everybody had this in their top five, top 10. Brett Woden, shout out, 22, and he loves it. One thing that I found really fascinating through reading about it or through reading that forum was there is a whole group of fans that saw their first Dave Matthews shows in like 2009 and beyond. And that is an era that I am just completely ignorant of at this point in time. And I cannot wait to dive in to hear like, what is it that drew people? And it's the same thing. This is number four. It's the same thing with Fish. There's so many fans that we talked to who got Fish post 2009.
Yeah.
And that appeal of the 90s of what this band was putting out, I've got to imagine still bleeds into the reason why someone would get into them in a later period. But I'm really fascinated to explore like, what are the current things that are happening that people are really into?
And thanks Brett for that. It's fun to have people following along as we go through this. So Brian, after the number 41, to me, the show like takes a slight dip before the encore here, but that might just be me. What did you think about the kind of last third of this set? So Much to Say, and then there's what, two, you know, three songs or so before they close it out, because we have to talk about the encore. But
we have to talk about the encore. When I look at, or when I was listening to this, when I was looking at it on paper, So Much to Say and Too Much are, I love Carter's drums on So Much to Say. So Much to Say and Too Much are kind of like this second tier single that I've always thought of for the band. They're quality songs. They're a bit obvious, especially Too Much in terms of like the lyrical themes. And Drive In, Drive Out, though, I think is one of the more fascinating, especially live songs to hear. Every time I've seen it live, it has that same quality that Rapunzel has that you were talking about, where it feels like there's like 50 people on stage and really there's, you know, 7 or 8 at any given time. And it doesn't feel cacophonous, but there's so much going on. Carter's drums just blow me away in this song. And Trippin' Billy's is one of the best set closers that this band has written from a vibe standpoint, from a lyrical standpoint. So I was kind of up and down. I was right there with you. Like if I was going to take a bathroom break at any point during the show, it was probably going to be around Too Much, but you know, and then get back for the encore, because the encores tend to be pretty special for this band. But yeah, I mean, any additional thoughts that you had in that regard?
No, I mean, you're right about Trippin' Billy's. It's just what a great vibe and a great way to close a show. I think the I want to ask. We're going to get into our jams of the show and our MVPs. And in the MVP section, I have a question I want to ask you, but. Matt, for those listening, Matt commented 98 is like DMB's 1974, which is an interesting comparison. And that's why we're here. We're here to share smart people's insights, like people like Matt. So we're just here as a conduit to smart people who listen to music. Brian, do you want to tell us about the next sort of section of this where we get into our awards ceremony?
Yeah, we are going to, so every episode we're going to award a couple different segments, and this may evolve. This will grow over time. This is our first episode. We don't know what this is all going to be. So we may have like very nuanced award ceremonies here going forward, but we want to celebrate what we see as, and this is a good segue as well into the encore, what we see as the jam of the show. And our jam of the show is presented by Cash or Trade. Our friends over at Cash or Trade asked their members which Dave Matthews Band tickets were the hardest to get this summer, and the answer was a resounding SPAC, Saratoga Performing Arts Center. Cash or Trade is giving away 2 pavilion tickets, and if you know anything about SPAC, you got to be in the pavilion. 2 pavilion tickets to DMB at SPAC to 1 lucky winner. You can enter for a chance to win by heading over to cashortrade.org/grateful giveaway. We're going to post this in the show notes, and I believe we'll be posting this here shortly on the screen. So bear with us, but cashortrade.org/grateful giveaway for a chance to win 2 pavilion tickets to DMB at SPAC. Pretty amazing stuff. Head over to cashortrade.org. Cash or Trade is the presenting sponsor of the Jam of the Show segment. And RJ,
you don't want to be in the SPAC lawn. I just want to say that one more time.
I've been there. You don't want to be there. The second I had a chance to get inside, I got inside and I was like, this is a whole different venue. So RJ, what is your jam of the show today?
I mean, I kind of already showed my hand here. Number 41, just phenomenal jam. I really, having Bela Fleck and Jeff Coffin and Tim Reynolds on there, I know that this was released as a separate sort of track on another compilation. I think this is, to me, this is just the peak of the whole thing. And it might just be, again, nostalgia. I love this song, but the way that all these musicians are interacting on stage, it goes into a really great place with the drums being just like held down while everyone else is kind of improvising over it. I was really impressed by that moment. What about you?
I don't think you're wrong. It's a beautiful pick, and it was my number 2. I think my number 1 goes to the encore slot, the last stop, which is a song that always fascinated me before These Crowded Streets came out. You've got a lot of Middle Eastern influences in the songwriting from Trey at the time. This kind of bled over into the version of Halloween that shows up on Before These Crowded Streets as well. Dave at the time,
you said Trey.
I said Trey. That was a massive faux pas. That there are no more fish references allowed for this. I apologize.
That's great.
That's hilarious.
Sorry for calling it out. I just wanted to do it before someone else did. Yeah.
That's why we're here together. But the last stop is, it's one of my favorite songs by the band. And this performance, you've got Bela Fleck that joins them again at this point in time. The whole band is up on stage with Bela. It's got this prelude jam. It's got this elongated closing segment that gets really quiet, really beautiful. You get a ton of Bela Fleck in there just showcasing what he offers to this band sound. And the last like 4 or 5 minutes when Dave starts singing again, he comes in a couple of times and then they just fade this track out and they fade the show out. And he just wishes everyone, you know, thank you. Have a great night. Be well to each other. The kind of sentiment that Dave always has at his shows that like is, you know, this idea of brotherhood, collective unity that I really like about their performances. It just ends on such a fantastic note, and it ending with this significant of a jam. I loved it.
That's a good, yeah, it's great. I mean, this is how you do an encore, you know, 25 minutes,
yes,
two songs, incredible jam, you know, other bands who are watching, this is how you do an encore. I want to put up a comment from Davis. Davis is a friend of mine who's the brother of one of my closest friends in the world. And thank you, Davis, for hopping on. Interesting comment, notably missing from the show are two hardcore fan favorites from the album Dreaming Tree and Spoon. Lots of us chase those songs. So that's like, that's good context for this album tour. And everyone who's commenting, keep sending comments and keep telling us what you like and don't like. And if you don't like the fact that Brian and I are not as big Dave Matthews fans as you are, then that's okay. You can tell us that too. Brian, who's your MVP of the show?
My MVP is Stefan Lessard. I think that, and it's going to be really interesting to kind of ebb and flow from an era standpoint with this. This era to me is all about him. I was looking at, you know, the night before 12/7, they also play at the Worcester Centrum. They play a 11-minute crush during that show. That song is so like defined by his bass line that brings us into it. But I find, especially in the jamming segments, the ending of Seek Up, the middle jam segment of 41, and parts of The Last Stop are just defined by Stefan's bass and what he holds down and what he adds to the band at this point in time. So I couldn't help but like keep going back and listening to him. And I would just love to have like an isolated track of his bass throughout this overall show. He's fascinating. What about you? Who's your MVP?
Well, so this like leads into my question. My MVP, I think, is Tim Reynolds. And as I was listening to this show, I was thinking like, is this the most popular or most successful band that didn't have an electric guitarist?
Like, that's a really interesting question. Yeah.
You know,
it's
like,
yeah,
I mean, there are bluegrass bands and there are other bands that follow this path, but like to be this successful and this long lasting without a full-time electric guitarist is just kind of fascinating. I'm sure I've thought about that before, but not in a long time. And I was sort of like dumbfounded because I think he adds so much.
I think he adds so much. It's interesting because like having him on this tour adds so much to these performances. But at the same time, if I think back to what appealed to me about Dave Matthews Band in the late 90s, it was that they did not have a lead guitarist. It was that they were able to create such a vibe and create so much dynamics in their overall playing without a lead guitarist. But then when they added him, it was just like a perfect fit because he'd been playing with Dave for so long. And every time he sat in, it added another element, another layer to their overall shows. So yeah, I mean, I think I'm having a hard time coming up with a band on the spot that like had a bigger career without a guitar solo.
It's crazy. I just think he adds a lot. Like when he comes in, you're like, oh yeah, there's the electric guitar. And then on some of those jams, it's just really, really adds a lot. So we are going to we're going to attempt to keep these shows to about 45 minutes, and we're almost there. But Brian, we have one more thing we have to say, and I think you kind of mentioned this earlier. If you've been to shows with me, you know I take a lot of bathroom breaks. It's part of just how my life works. And we're going to talk about our bathroom break song. I will tell you, Brian, that I took a bathroom break at Goose on Saturday night during one of my favorite songs because I had to, and it was during Creatures in the second set, because I knew that if I didn't, because I knew what was going to happen in the third set, and I was like, I can't mess with like the set break thing. And so I just want you to know that I did that on Saturday night. But if I were at this show, I probably would have gone taking a break during Don't Drink the Water, which might have been a bad choice.
Are you not a fan of Don't Drink the Water?
I think it's a good song, and this does have like, you know, the guests on it. I just think at that point in the show, I would have been like, all right, time to take a break. Time to take a break before Jimmy thing. Not that I would have known that was coming next, but in retrospect, knowing what I know, that's when I would have taken a quick break. What about you?
I would have taken it. Well, I just want to say really quick, the Creatures bathroom break move is a really smart one. I've learned this at a multitude of shows. You go to the bathroom when you know that a band is going to jam a song out, and you know you have like some time to get through the song. Even though Creatures is a great song, you just know like the lines are going to be short. I am going to wait much later in the show, because I tend to just like kind of torture myself if I have to go to the bathroom during a concert, and just like, how long can I wait this out? And I'm waiting until Too Much. And if there's someone out here who can convince me that this is a really, really great song, I am all ears. I am as open-minded as possible walking into this podcast, because like I said at the top, there are aspects of this band's history that are a complete blind spot to me that I'm so excited to discover. Too Much has always sounded like the kind of song that you would write about consumerism in the 1990s while still buying a lot of crap. Like, that's my sentiment around this song. It's like, I just buy a lot of stuff. I don't want to buy a lot of stuff. And that's what I have to say about it.
Yeah.
I'm not a huge fan of it. And I would have gone to the bathroom at that point, knowing that coming back, I still have Drive In, Drive Out, Trippin' Billy's, the encore break, and this fantastic encore. So I feel like we both would have been in good spots. You would have come back well-rested for the rest of the show. I would have been well-rested for the closing of the show, plus whatever's going to happen out on the lot. We know that we're still going to get into it after the show.
Yeah, that's true. And I will say that at Fish shows, I will often run to the bathroom at the very end of the set, like while the jam is about to end. Cause like, if you just as a note for people, if anyone wants this advice, if you're at a show and they're playing Antelope and like they come back into the breakdown, if you go to the bat, you can see as you're walking up the aisle, everyone's just standing there staring, and they're not really doing that much. Like, the jam's over, but you're going to beat the traffic. So I just want to give people a heads up. All right. So Brian, we are going to come back tomorrow. 12 o'clock, and we're going to jump forward 6 years to Live Tracks Volume 2, which is from 2004 in San Francisco, which I'm excited about because I think a lot of stuff changed in those, you know, 6 years. So we're going to be back then. Is there anything else you want to say to our friends out there before we wrap it up?
No, thank you to everyone for giving us a shot here with this new venture. I'm really excited. We discussed a really great show here today. I only messed up Dave and Trey one time. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but I'm excited for this next show. This is definitely an era that this was right around the time that I just kind of stopped listening to the band. And there's this like big gap of time that like I will be discovering a lot about them. Really quickly here, just Brett Woden, how many episodes per band? The goal of the show is that every single band gets a full dedication to their live release catalog. So there are currently 59 live tracks is out. We will do all 59. If they put out more as the show's going on, which they probably will, the last one came out in April, we'll keep going. We'll return to them at some point. But currently you get 59 Dave Matthews episodes right now, and TBD on where that goes.
And I will say that we're open to doing a chunk of Dave Matthews and then moving on to another band, doing a chunk of another band, coming back to Dave Matthews, or just going straight through. We're going to see what everyone thinks. So as we get, you know, 5, 6, 7 episodes into this, tell us, let us know. Let us know via the chat here. You can find us on social media at Osiris Pod. You can email us on our website. You can tweet, Instagram, Facebook. You know how to get a hold of us. And yeah, thanks for giving us a shot. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for all the comments. And we're going to be back tomorrow at noon. So I hope to see and hear some of you guys then. So thank you. Cyrus.